This recording is a production of Faith Builders Resource Group. This recording was made at REACH 2017, held on March 23 and 24, 2017, in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Good morning and welcome. We're honored to have Dennis Yoder as our speaker this morning on Unseen Integrity, Developing and Implementing Effective Internal Control. He's told me that mishandling funds can ruin an organization's reputation for many years. And through his interaction with nonprofit organizations and through dealing with their taxes and accountings, he has discovered large gaps in their internal control. Dennis has worked at Faith Builders for 7 years. He was business office manager, overseeing and developing the financial policies and internal control. He's currently a treasurer for 2 nonprofit organizations, working with about 20 nonprofits, providing tax and accounting for individuals, businesses, and other nonprofits through his own tax and accounting business. So, Dennis, if you come forward, I'll have a short word of prayer, and I'll turn it over to you. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, I just pray you would be with Dennis this morning, give him clear words to speak, and that's something that we can all learn, take home, and apply to our business. Pray this all in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. Thank you, Seth. Okay, so our topic this morning is entitled Unseen Integrity, Developing and Implementing Effective Internal Controls. So I want to start out by talking about a house. You didn't know you were coming to a construction session. This house was across the road from my parents and was an eyesore in the community, kind of place where, you know, nobody lived there for 2 years. The roof was falling in, and it just a lot of problems in this house. So I learned to know the owner, and he was actually interested in selling. And so about a year ago, I actually purchased this house. And through a process of time in which I got an education that I hadn't been planning on, the house now looks like this. But in a project like this, I learned one thing definitely, and that is that you don't just throw money at the project and expect everything to happen, you know, to come out exactly the way you want it. In business, we generally know that, you know, when you place an order for something, you don't pay up front for the entire order, right? You know, you pay half of it, and then if the order comes out the way you want it to be, you pay the other half. That makes sense in business. However, we don't always apply things like that to our ministries. Donors, a lot of times, trust us to the point where they pay the whole thing up front. They give their entire donation, and, you know, of course, we might hope that they give us more donations in the future if we handle them well, but they are trusting us to actually have the systems in place in our organizations to handle those funds well. And there are some builders like that. So, for example, when I contacted someone to put carpet in the house, I paid them the whole amount up front. I've seen their work. I trust them. They're known in the community. And, you know, I'm fine with that. Others, not so much. Today, I want to tell you how you can maybe put some systems in place so that you can be an organization where people can know they can pay you completely up front, knowing that you will do what you say you do, and you'll do what they want you to do with their funds. So we're going to look at some definitions, first of all, and you all have a handout. You should have a copy of the handout, and the definition is printed in there. But this is a definition that came from the American Institute for Certified Public Accountants, the AICPA. They define internal controls as a process affected by an entity's board of directors, management, or other personnel, designed to provide reasonable assurance regarding the achievement of objectives in the following 3 categories. In other words, this is a process. This is something that you have in place that you do regularly in your organization. It can be put in place by a variety of different people. It can be put in place by the board. It can be put in place by management. And it helps to give them, since the board of directors is overseeing the organization, helps to give the directors on the board, assurance that the organization is doing what it set out to do. There's effective and efficient operations. Internal controls also assures that there's reliability of financial reporting. In other words, the reports that come out of the organization actually are stating what is going on in that organization. It helps assure them that there's compliance with applicable laws and regulations. So it helps your organization avoid running into trouble with the IRS or with other regulatory state organizations and so forth. So, internal controls are a process affected by an entity's board of directors, management, or other personnel designed to provide reasonable assurance regarding the achievement of objectives in the effectiveness and efficiency of operations, reliability of financial reporting, compliance with applicable laws and regulations. Internal controls can be judged as effective in each of these categories if the board of directors and management have reasonable assurance that they understand the extent to which the organization's operations objectives are being achieved. In other words, these controls are working if they can be reasonably sure that the organization is doing what it's supposed to be doing. They also know they're working if the published financial statements are prepared reliably. So in other words, the statements that are going out are actually reflecting what happened in the organization, and if applicable laws and regulations are being complied with. In other words, the state laws, the federal laws, and so forth are being complied with. Now, this definition is very broad and can oversee a lot of different things. Today, we'll be focusing mostly on finance. That's my background. It's what I've worked in. And frankly, that's where I've seen some of the biggest lapses in organizations, is having controls in place that ensure that they are doing what they're supposed to be doing with the funds. Now, I say that there's lapses there. I don't mean to say that our organizations are mishandling funds. I'm merely saying that they could, without internal sources maybe catching those problems. So, in summary, internal controls are systems that ensure that operations, financial reporting, and compliance with laws and regulations are being conducted with the utmost integrity. And I would point out that the key words there are systems and integrity. Internal controls have to be systematic. If they're not systematic, they're going to fall by the wayside. So it has to be something that we're doing over and over again. This is not something that, oh yeah, we probably should do that. This is just the way business is done. And that's what the controls should be. They must be systematic. They also have to have integrity as their goal and their driving force. So that's the reason that we're implementing internal controls. Most people don't wake up in the morning and say, oh, joy, internal controls. I get to think about that again today. Internal controls is something that facilitates something else. In this case, integrity is the goal and is what we are making sure that we do as we develop internal controls. So why bother to develop internal controls? The first thing I would say is that there is a lot of biblical basis for this topic. You don't really think of the Bible providing a lot of guidance in nonprofit governance, and yet it does. 1 Corinthians 8:21 talks about providing for honest things, not only in the sight of the Lord, but also in the sight of men. We see Paul espousing internal controls. He doesn't just go collect an offering and then go miles away on a big trip and then deliver the offering. He actually sends two people. He sent Titus and two other people to Corinth to collect their gift. That's terrific internal controls. And we'll see later as we go through this that having more than one person handling the money is crucial. Not just one person, because, you know, one person takes it and you hope the right amount ends up in the other end. And even if it does, if somebody questions it, there's no way for that person to prove that it actually did get there. So there's definitely a biblical basis for internal controls. Internal controls make integrity visible. And I like this quote from the ECFA, the Evangelical Council for Financial Accountability. They say, accountability to God is vital, But people form their impressions of people and organization by looking at the outward appearance. Accountability to God is vital, and I would agree with that. But your accountability to God is not visible unless the outward appearance also portrays that. Your accountability to God is judged based on your outward appearance. And so for better or for worse, the outward appearance definitely matters. John 3, 19 to 21, and this is the condemnation: that light is come into the world, and men loved darkness rather than light, because their deeds were evil. For everyone that doeth evil hateth the light, neither cometh to the light, lest his deeds should be reproved. But he that doeth truth cometh to the light, that his deeds may be made manifest, that they are wrought in God. It doesn't say that those who do good have to come to the light. No, they want to come to the light. They want people to see what they're doing, because what they are doing is in the light and is showing what God wants, which is integrity. So internal controls make integrity visible. Internal controls also remove temptations. And Romans talks about being careful not to put a stumbling block or an occasion to fall in our brother's way. This is one that I'm passionate about. I feel really badly. In fact, it makes me feel terrible when I see a ministry that gave someone an opportunity to mishandle funds. Okay, I'm not saying it was the organization's fault that this person took the opportunity and did what they shouldn't do. But come on, can't we put things in place that remove temptations from each other? We get it in some areas. We do. Modesty is one that comes to mind first off. In our churches, we believe that, you know, we need to remove some of these temptations. We believe in a lot of ways that you remove the temptation of stealing money with the way that even with the way that our ministers are not paid. You know, in a lot of our churches, the ministers are not they are not tempted to tailor their message to what will pay well. The goal is that they will preach what needs to be preached. We remove the temptation of, you know, chasing after money. Internal controls do the same thing in our organization. They remove the temptation for people to steal or mishandle funds. Internal controls also provide safety. So I mentioned earlier about, you know, Paul taking the money, and how did the people around him know that what got to the other end was what started out? That's internal controls. Internal controls provide safety. And for myself, as I worked at Faith Builders, I was glad that there were a lot of internal controls in place. Because if the board came to me and said, hey, there were some checks written that we kind of have questions about, you know, were you doing something what you should have been? Hey, my signature's not on the check. Go talk to Steve. He approved it too. It doesn't come back to me. Internal controls provide a lot of safety. They provide a lot of safety for me as a worker in the ministry. Provide a lot of safety for the people working alongside you or maybe under you, depending what your role is in the board. Internal controls provide safety in that they know that their integrity isn't going to be called into question as soon as something goes wrong, because they aren't the only ones in this, and they aren't the ultimate authority that approves or disallows something. Internal controls are also an indication of something larger. So the IRS developed a new Form 990 several years ago. And on that form, there's quite a number of questions that refer to internal controls. So they're asking things like, does the organization have a conflict of interest policy? Does the organization have a document retention and destruction policy? And people looked at that and said, what does that have to do with a tax filing? These are not financial questions that they're asking. Why are they asking these questions? And the IRS said, well, actually, it's pretty simple. Because we have found a very direct link between organizations that have these policies in place and organizations that are doing what they say they're doing. That makes a lot of sense to me, actually. You see an organization that is well-run, that is has the policies in place, have put thought into these various areas. I'll show you an organization that is going to be doing what they say they're doing. They're not going to be mishandling funds. They're not going to be deceiving the public in their fundraising and so forth. When they have these policies in place, it's much more likely that they are operating with integrity in other areas as well. The worst case scenario, of course, is that we want to avoid fraud. And I say that's a worst case scenario. I look at it a bit like I look at divorce. Fraud is sort of a worst case scenario and is a symptom of something that went wrong a long time ago. Fraud is something that is prevented by a way of life in the organization, not merely by, we need to make sure that we keep fraud at bay. Yeah, but that comes naturally as we have these internal controls. So a couple questions that I would suggest that you ask in your organization. One is, how can we minimize the temptations to steal from our organization? How can we eliminate temptation to fudge the numbers? In other words, when we're releasing a financial report, how can we remove the temptation to, well, we could kind of tweak things a little on the financial reports? And what are the areas that are most susceptible to misunderstanding from people outside the organization? How can we demonstrate integrity in those areas? Notice I'm not saying, what are the areas that are most susceptible to us doing something wrong? I'm saying, what are the areas that are most susceptible to people outside our organization misunderstanding it? And how can we show that actually, yes, we are going above and beyond what we need to do in that area? One that comes to mind and one that I'll mention later is conflict of interest. So, we have an organization and somebody needs to cut the grass. And over the summer, most of the staff have off because it's a school. So, hey, why don't we hire the principal to cut the grass? Makes a lot of sense to me. He has off too. He has a lawnmower. He might as well bring it and cut the grass for us. Well, what if people outside of the organization find out that, there's a lot of people that, have these lawn mowing businesses that would love to have the school's business, but, they let the principal do it. Ooh, yeah, you can tell who's padding their pocket. Those kinds of questions can come up very quickly. But if you have the policies in place where they know that, no, before you hired him, you got bids from three other organizations. And he looked at it and said, well, hey, I don't have the overhead. I can do it for a lot cheaper. And so they went with the cheaper option. That makes a lot of sense to people. And that just avoids that entire conversation. It avoids all that question as to, well, were these things actually done the way they should be done? So what are the areas that are most susceptible to misunderstanding in your organization? And how can you demonstrate integrity in those areas? I'm going to go now to some very practical application. What I think are five crucial internal controls that every organization should have. One of those is income verification. So what do I mean by income verification? Income verification ensures that income is reported accurately and involves things such as donation tracking, receipting, and reporting. It involves accounting software reconciliations. So what are some examples of income verification? Well, some things I think of are an organization that I work with where the treasurer checks the post office box, he gets all the donations, keeps a spreadsheet with all the donations, and then gives them to me. I take those donations, enter them into the accounting software, and take them to the bank to deposit them. Right there, you have two people handling the funds. The treasurer gets a copy of the deposit receipt. He can check to make sure that the checks he pulled out of the box actually went to the bank. He's got that receipt and can double check those numbers. You can also double check the spreadsheet with financial reports that are issued by the organization. Is the organization accurately reporting what they received? Another way of doing income verification is printing donor restrictions or preferences on the receipt that you send to them. So if you have a lot of people sending in donations, some of them might say, hey, I'd like it to go to this certain part of the ministry. Print that restriction on the receipt when it goes back to them. Might seem like a small thing, but it's a way of holding yourself accountable that, yes, we saw your designation and we are going to honor that. So, you get a receipt that comes back and it isn't what you sent in. gives you an opportunity to hold them accountable and say, hey, actually, I wanted my donation to go here, and I see, you know, you're using it here. What's going on? Simple way that small organizations even can put an internal control in place there. Another one is to issue receipts in a timely manner so that donors actually remember what they sent and can reconcile it with the donation receipt they received. I haven't done that, always done so well in some of the organizations I've been with, but this is one that can be an easy way of letting the donor hold you accountable for what you received. And then they know if you didn't get it. If it goes a month or two and they don't get a receipt, hey, what's going on? Did it get lost in the mail? Did someone steal it from the organization? Who knows? And also prompt depositing of donations. So again, if you give a donation to somebody and it doesn't clear for a month or two, okay, so I recognize that sometimes it's convenient to go to the bank with a whole stack rather than with a check or two. But when I see that, I wonder how many other things are piling up on their desk and aren't being taken care of in a timely manner. So it's just a simple, something as simple as depositing donations promptly can be a sign of integrity. So income verification. Also mentioned accounting software reconciliations. If you're a larger organization, you might actually be operating two different sets of software where one is tracking relationship with the donor, where you're tracking your donations there, and another software is tracking your financial information. Reconcile those two. Reconcile them on a regular basis. If possible, have different people operating those software, those two different softwares, so that one is entering the donations, one is keeping the financial books. Are the two reconciling? And if they're run by two different people, again, that ensures that two different people are seeing these numbers. Expense approvals is a second area. Expense approvals ensure that funds are used to further the stated purpose of the organization and according to donor intent. Some examples of those could include credit card expenditures, check writing and signing, bank statement reconciliations. So, in this area, especially, I would say the segregation of duties is very important. It's very important to have multiple people involved in this area. So, an example at Faith Builders, the check printing and signing and mailing and the bank statement reconciliations is all done by five different people. Well, I take that back. Four people, I think. So, when I was there, one person would turn in the bill and say, "Okay, this bill needs to be paid." They would give it to me. Actually, they would give it to Vivian. Vivian would enter the information into our accounting software. I would pull the bill and print the check. The check would go to Steve. He signs it, and he gets a copy of the bill as well, so he can compare the bill with the check and make sure that you know, everything is good there. Gives it back to Vivian. Vivian mails the check. And so right there you see that the person who submitted the bill has seen the bill and approved it. I have seen the bill and approved it. Steve has seen the bill and approved it. Vivian has seen the bill and approved it. The more eyes you have on these things, the better, generally. Now, don't go overboard with it, and we'll talk some later about one of the reasons that internal controls breaks down is if they're too cumbersome. So, you know, everybody in the organization has to sign off before we can send a check out. No, I'm not espousing that, but I am saying have a couple sets of eyes on this. And like I mentioned earlier, this is not only to keep me from writing out a check that I shouldn't be writing out. This is to keep me from feeling badly if something goes wrong and I was the only person that approved it. You want at least two people approving expenses if possible. Another example of this could be that, if you only have two people in the office, have one person write out the checks and the other person sign them. Or one person write out the checks and sign them, and the next person gets the bank statement and looks over it before it's given to somebody else to reconcile. That's an easy way. At Faith Builders, for example, when the bank statement comes, goes in Steve's box, he always knows it's unopened when he gets it. So nobody touches it before he touches it, pulls it out of the envelope. He just makes sure that his signature's on all the checks. That simple. If his signature's on all the checks, nobody else is writing out checks, obviously. And so there's some simple things like that you can do where someone sees the bank statement, somebody other than the person who writes out the checks, or who prints the checks, just to make sure that nothing is going on there that is questionable. Cache protocols. Cache protocols reduce temptation surrounding the organization's most slippery assets. As an accountant, I have a strong dislike for cache. Cache disappears like you wouldn't believe. I don't know if you find it that way. I haven't found it that way in my wallet. You know, somehow, once it turns into cash, you might as well just write it off because it just disappears. Way too often, cash has a tendency of doing that if we're not very careful with it in an organization as well. So who has access to your petty cash box? Do you do petty cash reconciliation? So if you have a fund that you pay for small expenses out of that fund, who actually looks at it and verifies that the leftover amount is actually what it should be? And do you have protocols for cash income? So when at all possible, have at least two people count cash when it comes in. So if your church is taking offerings, I would strongly recommend having at least two ushers that would count the offering. They're there together until the amount is written in ink on the envelope and the envelope sealed. At that point, you know, the whole thing could disappear, but nobody's going to be taking part of it out because it is, you know, it's written down and you know that the correct amount was written down. Having two people is very important for cash especially. And reconcile petty cash often. Don't wait a year. Now, if your organization is very small, maybe once a year. But in most cases, organizations that try to reconcile petty cash once a year have no idea where the extra $50 got to because it's way too long ago to remember what all happened. And reconcile it regularly. There's much greater chance that people can remember, oh, yeah, that's right. I did, you know, take this money down to the post office to pick up our newsletter returns, or whatever it might be. Reconcile it regularly. So then two policies that I would mention that is crucial for an organization to have. One is a conflict of interest policy, which communicates a concern for integrity and a commitment to the mission of the organization. And some examples of things that should be addressed there are, what about hiring family members? What about contracting with a related party? So a related party being someone who, you know, maybe their brother, somebody on the board, their brother owns a landscaping business. In my case, sometimes I'm a relative of somebody who's on the board, and so they get me to do process payroll for the organization. That is fine. There's nothing against hiring family members. There's nothing against hiring related parties. Not a problem. But it is definitely best to have a policy in place that talks about how do you go about this hiring process? How do you go about making sure that it's best for the organization to hire this particular person? And I would also say this is often more a consideration of how it looks than of how it actually is. So much more often with a conflict of interest, it's not so much that it's bad for the organization as that it looks bad for the organization. And we're not all about looks, but people do judge us based on our outside appearance. And be careful about this one. There's been a lot of organizations who have kind of gotten a bad name because, well, yeah, they kind of hire people that are kind of insiders and they kind of, you know, they kind of, a family runs it or, you know, whatever it might be. Not a good thing. Something that might be helpful in your organization is to have something where the board or an administrative team has to approve these conflicts of interest or related party transactions. But if you do something like that, I would suggest a dollar threshold. So at Faith Builders, we had a $1,000 annual threshold. In other words, if I'm going to hire somebody to do a $300 job, go hire them. An organization the size of Faith Builders really doesn't need to scrutinize every $300 transaction. But if it's going to be worth more than $1,000 in a year, yeah, get the administrative team to look at it and sign off on it. So a dollar threshold can be a good way of not getting mired down in the minutia and yet having a very practical set standard that, okay, everybody knows over this level, you need to get approval before you move ahead with it. And even if you have hired someone and it's going well, periodically get quotes from someone else. So if you hire your brother to do the payroll processing, every couple of years, get paychecks or somebody to come in, a local accountant to give you a quote, just to make sure that things are still advantageous to the organization the way you're doing them. Compensation policy is also important, which demonstrates a greater concern for the mission than for personal gain. So who sets the director's salary in your organization? How do you know the salaries that are paid are fair? Have a policy in place, if possible, that says who sets these salaries. Is it the board? Is it the administrator? How do they go about setting these salaries? And then I would also say that salary should periodically be reviewed for fairness as compared to a similar position in another organization. So maybe stating this policy another way, if donors knew how much you're making, would they have a problem with it? I know in most of our organizations, the people that are in missions, you can tell they're not in it for the money, right? They're not being paid as much as the majority of the church is making. And I think I have various opinions on that. But if donors knew how much you were making, would they have a problem with it? Is a question that you can ask. So, with all this in mind, five crucial internal controls that I think every organization should have: income verification, should have an expense approvals process for approving expenses, should have protocols in place for how you handle cash, should have conflict of interest policy in place, and should have a compensation policy in place. These are not all-inclusive. There are a lot more than this that you could have in your organization, depending on your organization. But these are five that I always recommend that organizations would have, simply because these are, I think, sort of a baseline set of internal controls that you can have in your organization. Just very briefly, why internal controls might break down. One of them is if internal controls are too broad. So if the rules are so broad that they don't really mean anything, they're not going to help your organization. I mentioned reconciling the cash box once a year. That's, in my mind, that's an internal control that's so broad that it really isn't helpful. You need to do it more often than that. Having the treasurer glance over the financial statements, once or twice a year, probably is not sufficient for approving all the expenses. You need to have controls that are actually narrow enough that they mean something. So internal controls break down if they're too broad. They also break down if they're too cumbersome. So if you spend so much time on maintaining internal controls in your everyday work, you're going to be much more tempted to ignore them and say, you know what? I know we say we're going to do that, but actually we do it this way. And that kind of culture can get started in an organization and you wind up where internal controls, they're so cumbersome to do everything that we say we're going to do, and you kind of start fudging and skirting around them. Or if management continually overrides controls. So there are times when management will need to override a control. There are times when most of the people in your organization probably will need to override a control. And, you'll have to know your people to know how okay you are with that. But, a toothbrush only prevents tooth decay if you actually use it. Internal controls will only help you if you aren't continually overriding them. If you are continually overriding them, it's an indication probably that controls are too cumbersome. And you need to relook at them and say, okay, how should we go about these things? So an example of an override is in check signing. So I mentioned in Faith Builder, Steve signs all the checks. Okay, that's just, I don't sign checks, even if my name's on the bank account, because there needs to be a separate person doing it. But if Steve's gone, okay, now what do we do? Oh, we can't write checks. Okay, well, that is something that's going to be too tight. It's going to be too cumbersome. Thankfully, we have a backup signer on staff there, and I can go down to his office. It's a little more inconvenient, but he's there, and we can get it done. There could be cases where, you say we have this control in place. If it's impractical or you need something in an emergency, call the board treasurer, and they have authority to verbally okay it that, yes, go ahead, do what you need to do. Overrides are going to be a part of having internal controls, but if you're continually overriding them, it essentially takes away the benefit of the internal control. So, that being said, I'm going to open it up now for questions. Any questions on what I have to say or how it might apply to your organization? In your case, any questions? So a question I sometimes get is, okay, internal controls, great idea. Who's responsible to do this? Like, is this something the board's supposed to do? Is it something that management's supposed to do? Who actually is supposed to do this? Like most good answers, I would say it depends, which isn't very helpful. It depends on your organization. I think the board's responsibility should be to make sure that these policies do take place, do get put into place. They should be the ones that are helping to provide an atmosphere where these internal controls are being developed. But they don't necessarily need to be the ones drafting the minutiae. Quite frankly, the people that are doing the actual work often have a better understanding of what is needed and what is practical than what the board does. Of course, it depends on the size of the organization. In some cases, the board is very involved in everyday work. And so in that case, I would say that the board should be involved here. Any questions? Another frequent question that my clients ask are, so we're a really small organization, and it doesn't really make sense to segregate all this stuff among a lot of people. What about us? And my response looks different based on who the organization is and how many people are involved and what their geographic... Sometimes the board is spread all over the U.S., and it's... You know, you have one office and all the rest of the operations are overseas. That can get a little tough because you don't have a lot of interaction, a lot of people that can physically sign off on things. But what about having the board treasurer sign all the checks? You know, could you have a separate, he comes in once a week and signs the checks? Now, maybe there's checks that have to be written in between, but by and large, you know, he drops by once a week and just signs them all. Could the treasurer get the bank statement and take a look at it and make sure that there's nothing on the bank statement that he has questions about? I mentioned issuing receipts promptly so that donors can see that you're doing what you said you do. Could those receipts be signed by somebody? Be signed by a treasurer, for instance, who doesn't have anything to do with anything else in the organization. He just drops by once a month and signs all the receipts for that month. Just a way to... for him to see, okay, here's what's coming into the organization, here's how it's being requested to be handled. The donor sees that, you know, yes, there is somebody signing the receipt. Signatures on receipts aren't required, but they can be a good idea and a way of getting more than one person to see what's going on as far as the income is concerned. What about having an outside accountant come in once a month and take a look over the books? See if anything raises red flags. For somebody like me, I see so many different sets of books that I can fairly quickly run over a set of books and say, oh, that's kind of strange. What's going on there? You know, is everything going the way it should in this organization? It's something that you could consider having somebody do, and that can often be done remotely. They can remote into your system and do it remotely. Don't actually have to be present to do that. Another question that sometimes comes up is, so the board really doesn't care about internal controls? How can I convince them that they're important? And that can be a tough one because I realize that there are a lot of times bigger fish to fry than internal controls. I mean, when you need to do fundraising, you need to keep operations going, you need to, get staff, and you're sitting around talking about internal controls. I mean, get with the program, right? I would say that an organization without internal controls is like a bridge without guardrails. So I would assume that most of you drove over multiple bridges when you came here. How many of you actually hit the guardrails? I never have. But would I go across a long bridge that didn't have guardrails and feel just as safe as if they were there? I mean, hey, you trust the bridge, right? It's not a big deal. You know, you've never hit them before. An organization without internal controls, I think, is like a bridge without guardrails. Yeah, it works. You've seen the pictures that I have, too, from other countries where they have logs across the creek. They work. Mm-hmm. Until they don't. Keep it in mind, your organization's internal controls, frankly, are as much about protecting your workers as they are about protecting the mission. And having those controls in place helps the people that are working in your organization to be completely above board. Number one, it removes temptation, but it also avoids questions. So, you know, are these people doing what they're supposed to do? Yes, there's multiple people that have signed off on this. Any additional questions this morning? We have just a few minutes left.
You had mentioned briefly about when somebody, let's say, tags a donation for a specific thing. Mm-hmm. How important is that to make sure that it gets used for that if it's on a general basis? Person, maybe just, you know, support for so-and-so. Does that go specifically to that and tag for that, or does that generally go into the general fund?
Okay, so the question being, when someone restricts a donation, how important is it that, and I think probably one of the questions is, how important is it that you track all these donations to make sure that they go to where they're supposed to go? That varies a lot from organization to organization. So you brought up the instance of supporting an individual. That opens up a whole other can of worms, because we get into the thing of, well, can somebody give a gift for another individual and just pass it through an organization and get a charitable donation receipt? ECFA, the Evangelical Council for Financial Accountability, they say what you need to draw a distinction between a donor preference and a donor restriction. A donor restriction must be honored. I will just say that right up front. So if someone says this donation is to renovate this classroom, you had better use it to renovate that classroom. And I think that is a matter of integrity. We have to restrict that for use in that renovation. If someone says, I am giving this donation to help support this missionary over there, one of the important distinctions is, okay, is this a restriction or is this a preference? And as much as possible, I try to communicate to donors that their donations may be preferenced for an individual, but they may not be restricted to that individual. Now, am I splitting hairs? Probably. But here's the difference. So if you restrict it, if it's a restricted donation to an individual, yes, that should be tracked. And you should, you know, make sure it goes. But that is also not a tax-deductible donation. That's a gift to an individual. And they can't get a receipt for that. However, if they're saying, you know, we know you're supporting this person, we know that, you know, that you have on salary, I'd like my money to go toward that work, I'm fine with that. That is more of a preference. The preference being that the work that this person is engaged in receives these funds. Now, slightly different twist. I know a lot of our donors probably think they're supporting an individual, you know, if I don't, but the fact of the matter is, a lot of organizations, if a particular individual doesn't receive any restricted gifts for them, they're still going to get their paycheck this month. Some organizations, you know, they say, well, you know, the amount that comes in is directly tied to what you get. That's getting uncomfortably close to being personal donations, in my opinion. So what am I saying? To boil it down, I would say it is a matter of integrity that we track, at least broadly, and make sure that contributions from someone are being used for what they're sending them in for. But the fact is that most of our donors, when they restrict it to a person, are actually wanting it to go to that person's work. And, you know, whether it's his paycheck or whether it's the supplies that he uses to teach school. It's all being used for that person. So I don't know if that helps. Another thing that I think you do need to be careful about is that you do periodically check out that a particular sector of your organization that might be getting restricted gifts, make sure the expenses are greater than the income. So in other words, if there's an organization that is running a school and they're running, some other ministries and so forth, if there are donations restricted to that school, make sure that the school's total expenses exceed those restricted gifts. If that's the case, you're in the clear. Because those donations weren't specifically tracked to that place, but we know that we are using that gift and all the others that come in. We're using at least that much for that expense. If that makes any sense, do you have follow-up on that?
Well, that's good. The integrity part of following through on that, and then the conflict side that happens on the mission field side can be two different things, because the donation is posted specifically to the person, and the mission field policy is that they get their allowances paid, and the money going to these people, all of a sudden one person's getting more. So I think that's a mission field policy, and they have to do their discretionary usage of
right. Right. I would also I would also say that communication with the donors is also critical in this particular area. So what happens if you get more than what you need? So I've noticed that Christian Aid Ministries, just use them as an example, I've noticed their flyers all say in the bottom of their appeals, they all say if there's more funds than needed, it'll go into general operating. If the donor understands that, hey, if we get more than what we need, it'll go into general operating, then you have the freedom to do that. Even if, if that's clearly communicated, even if they say, I'd like you to go to this project, you still have some flexibility there.
Yeah. One thing that we have done, and that's primarily how we raise our funds, is for specific people.
Okay.
But the donors are aware that that money goes into the general fund. It is to provide their income, which includes salary, taxes, everything that's included in that. So they don't see 100% of those funds. And if someone writes a check to us and says, we want this money to go to him, we won't write that check. Because
right.
it's a pass-through,
right.
and it's a
win. Right. Right.
We'll give it to them as income, but we will not write them that check 100% because it puts us in jeopardy. Mm-hmm. And we let them know that up front, that this person may not see 100% of the funds you get. We don't pull any of those funds out for the organization if they aren't to support them.
But they, right. And it, and it might go to
the general fund. We track it for our purposes, but we don't track it. We only track it to make sure that person's salary is being covered.
Right. That certainly makes sense. And again, just emphasizing the communication with the donor, I think is very critical in that case. Thank you for attending today. If you have any other additional questions, my email address and phone number are listed on the handout. Feel free to send an email. And now I'm going to turn it back over to Seth to close the workshop.
This recording and many others are available from Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. For more information, call 1-814-789-4769 or visit us online at www.christianlearning.org.